The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We are reading this week from the January 31st, 2020 issue of The Week magazine. This is an unintended second reading from that. We didn't get the new issue this week, and sometimes that happens. So we'll make another pass at it and see what we can get. We'll start with one of the main stories we didn't pick up last week. Supreme Court may allow public aid to religious schools. What happened? The Supreme Court appeared ready this week to knock down state rules that block government aid to religious schools, a potential watershed victory for the Christian right. The court's five conservatives seemed to side with the Trump administration during oral arguments for Espinoza versus Montana, in which three low-income parents claimed their rights were violated when the state excluded religious schools from a 2015 state tax credit program. The Montana Supreme Court ultimately struck down the entire program, saying it violated the state's constitution's ban on taxpayer dollars supporting religious education, even indirectly. 36 state constitutions have no aid provisions similar to Montana's. Chief Justice John Roberts compared the parents' plight to racial bias. How is that different from religion, which is also protected under the First Amendment, he asked. The case could have far-reaching consequences as the court increasingly expands the ability of faith-based institutions to receive taxpayer dollars. In 2017, for example, the justices ruled 7-2 that a Lutheran church in Missouri could use public funds to resurface its playgrounds, with Roberts calling the state's restrictions odious to our Constitution. Montana's tax credits were meant to benefit private schools in general, but the bulk of them ended up going to religious schools. Now that the program has been eliminated, several justices questioned whether the issue is still relevant. I am having trouble seeing where the harm in this case is, Justice Elena Kagan said. There is no discrimination at this point. What the columnist said. This case could be a game changer for victims of religious discrimination, said Michael Helfand in the Wall Street Journal. It's been obvious for a long time that laws like Montana's single out religious institutions for worse treatment than their secular counterparts. In 2017, the Lutheran Church playground case focused on discriminatory impact, but the justices now have an opportunity to dramatically broaden religious liberty in areas such as school choice by cracking down on discriminatory intent. Justice Brett Kavanaugh correctly noticed that no aid laws are rooted in grotesque religious bigotry, said Nick Sibilla in TheAtlantic.com. These provisions are often called Blaine Amendments after the congressman who nearly passed a federal constitutional amendment in 1876 barring state funding for religious schools. Blaine Amendments targeted Catholic immigrants who felt public schools clashed with their values. Across the country, these laws continue to hide their prejudice behind a fig leaf of neutrality. That has things exactly backwards, said Rachel Laser in WashingtonPost.com. Private religious schools don't adhere to the same non-discrimination laws that public schools do. Those schools have denied admission because a student or parent is LGBTQ and fired teachers for being pregnant and unmarried. Funding religious institutions while giving them exemptions from laws they don't like is not equal treatment, it's religious privilege. Here's a short piece with a couple of items in it. Often they're a little bit funny. It's titled, Only in America. A deaf man is suing Pornhub.com because some of its X-rated videos lack subtitles. Yaroslav Suri of Brooklyn claims that a lack of closed captions violates the Americans with Disabilities Act and prevents him from fully enjoying such titles as Hot Step Aunt Babysits Disobedient Nephew. Pornhub responded that we do have a closed captions category. A proposed housing development in San Francisco would include tiny underground sleeping pods that could rent for $1,350 a month. The subterranean windowless pods would be only slightly larger than a king-size mattress, but could appeal to young workers who can't afford the sky-high rents of above-ground San Francisco. I can see this living arrangement isn't for everyone, concedes developer Chris Elsey. We'll go into the two sections titled The U.S. at a Glance and The World at a Glance that have some shorter news pieces. So the U.S. at a Glance, this from Seattle, Royal Hack. Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman sent Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos a video file containing malware in a WhatsApp chat in 2018 that enabled his security service to hack Bezos' phone, a cybersecurity firm hired by Bezos alleged this week. UN experts said the hack was part of a massive online campaign against Bezos in the months before the Saudi heir, known as MBS, ordered the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Bezos, who owns the Post, and MBS allegedly exchanged friendly texts before Bezos received a file that let the Saudis siphon massive troves of data. Bezos has accused Saudi Arabia of feeding the National Enquirer photos and information about his affair with Lauren Sanchez. Months after the alleged hack, MBS appeared to taunt Bezos by sending him a photo of a woman who looked like Sanchez with a sarcastic caption. Riyadh called the claim that Saudi Arabia hacked the phone absurd. Washington, D.C. Redacted in full. The Justice Department ignored a court order and failed to release memos about Jared Kushner, President Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor, CNN.com reported last week. Last October, a judge granted a Freedom of Information Act request by CNN and BuzzFeed News, requiring that a batch of interview notes from Robert Mueller's team be made public each month. The department has produced more than 800 pages of memos, many of which are heavily redacted. Yet the Kushner documents, set to be released this month, were entirely missing. The Justice Department gave no reason for excluding the Kushner interview. The latest notes that were released detail how Fox News host Sean Hannity served as a back channel to Trump, especially in text messages with former campaign chairman Paul Manafort after he was indicted. Manafort told investigators that Hannity urged him to hang in there because Trump had his back. Also from Washington, D.C., claim delayed. The Supreme Court denied a motion this week to review an attack on the Affordable Care Act before the presidential election. House Democrats in 20 Democratic-led states had pushed for an emergency appeal, hoping to draw voters' attention to a Republican lawsuit that could gut the health care law. The Trump administration argues that because Congress reduced the tax penalty on individuals who don't buy insurance to $0, the rest of the ACA should be invalidated. In December, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals agreed that the individual mandate is now unconstitutional, but didn't address whether it can be severed from the statute. District Judge Reed O'Connor of Texas ruled in 2018 that the entire law must go, staying his decision pending appeal. Democrats said the case poses a severe, immediate threat to millions of Americans. But the Supreme Court could now take years to weigh in. And from Ponce, Puerto Rico, wasted aid. Puerto Ricans devastated by an onslaught of natural disasters expressed outrage after a warehouse full of unused food, water, diapers, medicine, cots, and propane tanks was discovered last week. The disaster relief supplies, many of which are now expired, date back to Hurricane Maria, which led to the deaths of an estimated 3,000 Puerto Ricans in 2017. After enduring hundreds of earthquakes and aftershocks this month, residents stormed the warehouse in the southern city of Ponce, leading Governor Wanda Vasquez to fire Carlos Acevedo, director of the territory's Office of Emergency Management, plus several senior officials. As Puerto Rico fights for the release of $20 billion in relief funds allocated by Congress, the Trump administration imposed strict terms last week for delivering most of that aid, including a requirement that Puerto Rico pay contractors working on disaster relief less than $15 an hour. And from the world at a glance, this is from Oslo. Anger over ISIS wife. Norway's government was close to collapse this week after the Populist Progress Party quit the ruling coalition over its decision to repatriate from Syria a woman with suspected links to ISIS. The unnamed 29-year-old, who left Norway in 2013 and married twice in Syria, was brought back to Norway from a Kurdish-controlled detention camp so that her seriously ill 5-year-old son could receive medical treatment. Progress Party leader Siv Jensen said his members were prepared to welcome the woman's two children, but opposed letting in people who have voluntarily joined terrorist organizations and want to tear down all the values Norway is built on. The government said the mother was arrested upon arrival in Norway and that the children were in state care. Hundreds of European jihadists and their families remain in Syrian detention camps. This is from Brasilia. American reporter charged. Brazilian prosecutors have charged American journalist Glenn Greenwald with cyber crimes for his alleged role in obtaining damning messages from the cell phones of several Brazilian officials. The messages, published on Greenwald's website, The Intercept Brazil, showed that Sergio Moro, the judge who presided over the corruption investigation that brought down former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, was in improper contact with prosecutors. Moro is now justice minister under right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro. Prosecutors claim Greenwald didn't merely report on the hacked messages, but actively assisted in the hack. "I did nothing more than do my job as a journalist, ethically and within the law," said Greenwald, who lives in Rio de Janeiro with his husband, City Council member David Miranda, a socialist. This is from Luanda, Angola. Massive corruption. Angolan authorities have seized the domestic assets of Africa's richest woman, Isabel dos Santos, saying she and her husband looted the state of more than $1 billion. Documents obtained by the Platform to Protect Whistleblowers in Africa revealed how Dos Santos acquired stakes in the country's diamond industry, its biggest cement maker, two of its biggest banks, and state oil giant Sonangol through her father, José Eduardo Dos Santos, strongman president of the resource-rich nation from 1979 to 2017. His hand-picked successor, Hayo Lourenco, launched an anti-corruption drive soon after taking office. He fired Dos Santos as chair of Sonangol hours after her sacking. $38 million was transferred from the oil firm to a shell company in Dubai run by one of her friends. Dos Santos, who lives in the UK, denies the allegations and says she is the victim of a witch hunt. And from Canberra, Australia, plague of hail. Australia can't catch a break from the weather. Even as wildfires continue to blaze across much of the drought-parched country, a series of strong storms blew through the southeast this week, dumping baseball-sized hailstones that smashed office windows and car windshields in Canberra, Sydney, and Melbourne. "It was like Armageddon," said Canberra resident Hilary Warthall. "Powerful winds whipped up giant dust storms in rural parts of New South Wales, darkening the daytime sky. And in some areas, an inch of rain fell in only 30 minutes, causing flash floods. Despite the welcome rain, the fire danger continues. Since September, brush fires have killed at least 30 people, destroyed more than 2,000 homes, and consumed 38,000 square miles of land, an area nearly the size of Virginia. And we don't often read pieces from the People page, but hey, why not? Where Perez Gets Her Fire. Rosie Perez can frighten directors with her intensity, said David Marchese in the New York Times Magazine. A famously ferocious performer, the actress has sometimes been told on film sets that she's too difficult and emotionally explosive. "You're hiring me because I wear my heart on my sleeve," says Perez, 55. She admits to being easily triggered because her childhood left her with what she calls severe PTSD and chronic depression. Born in New York City to a single mother, the young Perez was sent to an upstate Catholic group home where she was sexually abused by nuns. "The patriarchy surrounded me," she says. "There was one of the major reasons nuns were so angry. They had no power within the system." As a young adult, Perez ignored the advice of her psychiatrist and decided to visit the group home in the hope that it would be cathartic. "There were just more demons brought in," she says. "Night terrors started coming like a faucet. I never want to go back to that place." The abuse ruined dogma and organized religion for her, but she still prays. "I do believe in energy. The energy of love is necessary for me. That's my religion. I made my own church." Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt ignited gleeful speculation this week when the former couple chatted happily and embraced backstage at the SAG Awards. Aniston, 50, and Pitt, 56, who are both single again 15 years after they divorced, were photographed beaming and briefly holding hands. Pitt teared up while watching Aniston accept an award for the morning show, while Aniston laughed and clapped at Pitt's joke about his failed marriage to Angelina Jolie. "It was a difficult part," Pitt said, of his award-winning role in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. "A guy who gets high, takes his shirt off, and doesn't get on with his wife." Brad has called Aniston a good friend, and they've both laughed off rumors about reuniting. Upon receiving his trophy, Pitt said, "I gotta add this to my Tinder profile." In a new anti-gun protest song, Eminem raps from the perspective of Las Vegas mass shooter Stephen Paddock. Darkness imagines Paddock's thoughts before he fatally shot 58 people and injured hundreds more at a Las Vegas music festival in 2017. "Law says sky's the limit, so my supply's infinite," Eminem raps about his arsenal as an actor fires out of a hotel window at screaming crowds. The video ends with the text, "When will this end? When enough people care. Register to vote." The album is called Music to be Murdered By. And we'll read a few of the columns that we didn't get to last week, starting with one titled, "Vaping Panic Will Lead to More Smoking." It's too late to unring the panic bell, said Anthony Fisher. But America's panic over vaping is the result of mass ignorance. The FDA's pending ban on the sale of flavored vape cartridges will do nothing to prevent the lung illnesses caused by bootleg vapes. The CDC recently confirmed that the lung epidemic was almost entirely confined to users of bootleg THC cartridges laced with vitamin E acetate, not cartridges made by Juul or other companies. A second panic involved vapes with fruit and candy flavors, which critics say lured teens into becoming addicted to the nicotine and vaping fluid. Concerns about nicotine addiction are valid. A recent study found that 25% of high school seniors are vaping, but that statistic must be put into context. In 1996, 26.6% of 12th graders smoked cigarettes daily. By 2018, just 3.6% smoked. That is a remarkable public health victory. For many teens and millions of adults, vaping is an effective smoking cessation tool, less dangerous than cigarettes, which kill 500,000 Americans a year. Banning vape flavors will backfire, driving millions of teenagers and adults back into the arms of big tobacco. The United Kingdom. Queen orders a hard Megxit. Despite their wish to be part-time royals, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle have been booted from the family business, said Victoria Ward in the Daily Telegraph. Following a summit with Harry, his brother, Prince William, and their father, Prince Charles, Queen Elizabeth II made a warm but firm announcement last week that her 35-year-old grandson and his American-born wife would no longer be working members of the royal family. The couple will have to stop using the title Royal Highness. They will remain the Duke and Duchess of Sussex, will no longer receive public monies, and will repay the $3.1 million in taxpayer funds used to renovate Frogmore Cottage, their home on the Windsor estate. Still, the Queen added, Harry, Meghan, and their 8-month-old son, Archie, will remain much-loved members of my family. Despite being cut off from the royal purse, the Sussexes won't be hard up. Harry has an inheritance of $13 million from his late mother, Diana, while Meghan has some $6.5 million from her TV and endorsement work. Prince Charles will also offer private financial support to the family as they embark on a new independent life in Canada. It's a hard Megxit, said Claire Foges at the Times. The Queen ruled that one must be all in or all out on royal duty. So her grandson is no longer a prince. But the deal looks like a genuine win-win. The Sussexes will get to winter in Aspen and summer in Tuscany, living their glamorous lives without the drudgery of hospice openings in Carlisle. And the quickness and cleanness of the decision was a victory for the Queen, whose legend as defender of the firm is burnished. No doubt Harry will regret giving up his honorary military titles. His decade in the British Army was reportedly one of his happiest periods in his life. But there will be many consolations in a life which glitters. Oh, but Harry wants our pity, said Piers Morgan in the Daily Mail. In a poor me speech after the Queen's announcement, Harry complained that the deal was not what he wanted, but that because of the big bad media, he had no option but to quit the monarchy. He's still peddling the tired narrative that racist coverage of his biracial wife drove the couple away. In fact, Meghan and Harry have spent their entire married life whining about everything and everyone. They're nothing but a pair of spoiled, entitled, hypocritical brats who wanted to profit off being royals, but not put in the work. The Queen quite rightly said no, because she won't have royalty flogging themselves to the highest bidders like grubby, tiara-clad second-hand car salesmen. With legions of followers on Instagram, the couple are well-placed to earn, said Andrew Morton in The Sun, but a career as celebrities will hardly afford them the privacy they claim to desire. If they thought they were under scrutiny before, They ain't seen nothing yet. And this column's from Israel. Tell us what happened to Wallenberg. 75 years after his disappearance, we still don't know the fate of the Swedish diplomat who saved thousands of Jews during the Holocaust, said Erwin Kotler. Raoul Wallenberg, a non-Jew who was stationed at the Swedish embassy in Hungary during World War II, is considered one of the righteous among the nations because of his exceptional courage. Before he arrived in Budapest in July 1944, some 440,000 Hungarian Jews had been deported to Auschwitz in 10 weeks, the fastest, cruelest, and most efficient mass murder of the Holocaust. Over the next 6 months, Wallenberg rescued 100,000 Jews by issuing diplomatic passports, setting up diplomatic safe houses, and warning Nazi generals that they would be executed for war crimes if they bombed a Budapest ghetto. Yet he was not himself saved. The Soviets, who entered Hungary as liberators in January 1945, sent Wallenberg to the Gulag and claimed he died there 2 years later. International inquiries, though, found compelling evidence that he was alive in the 1960s and possibly lived into the 80s. Russian President Vladimir Putin, who was in Israel this week to speak at the International Holocaust Commemorative Forum, should open the archives and tell us the fate of this hero of humanity. We're on the technology page, and we'll read a few of the short pieces. The first one they call the Innovation of the Week, which might be of particular interest to our audience. The first true smart contact lens could bring augmented reality right to the surface of your eye, said Julian Chakota in Wired.com. California-based Moho Vision has been working for 5 years on such a prototype, and it's still a few years away from becoming a real product. But they are now able to demo a lens that lets you look at the corner of your eye to activate an interface for what is billed as the smallest, densest display ever made. One demo app, Speech, acts as a teleprompter in your eye, projecting a speech so you don't have to look down at notes. The lens, which also corrects vision just like a regular contact lens, could also be used to improve night vision by outlining objects and figures. Tech bros go under the knife. Men in Silicon Valley are turning to plastic surgery and Botox to upgrade their professional image, said Peter Holly in the Washington Post. Long gone are the pleated khakis. The tech industry's obsession with youthful brain power has put added pressure on middle-aged male workers to comply with beauty standards that have long tormented women. If in Los Angeles men might try to match the look of movie stars, in Silicon Valley, mid-career workers are trying to match the fresh-faced vigor of Elon Musk, or look good in a fitted shirt like Amazon's Jeff Bezos, says one 40-year-old who gets Botox every 3 or 4 months. From my perspective, a $2,000 a year investment to make more money long term is definitely worth it. Right now, I can definitely pass for 30, no problem. Rise of hiring algos. College career counselors are trying to brace students for a stark new reality. They may be vetted for jobs in part by artificial intelligence, said Rachel Metz in CNN.com. More businesses are filling post-college openings by turning to services like HireVue, which uses AI to pour over videos sent in by candidates answering preset questions. The AI analyzes details such as words and grammar, facial expressions, and the tonality of the job applicant's voice, and uses them to score whether the candidate is tenacious, resilient, or good at working on a team. That's made students guinea pigs for a largely unproven mechanism for evaluating applicants. Sarah Ali, a Duke University undergraduate, started thinking about ways to optimize certain qualities or gestures after going through 8 HireVue interviews. The NSA won't hack Microsoft. The National Security Agency informed Microsoft last week that it had found a serious vulnerability in its Windows 10 operating system, said Lily Hay Newman in Wired.com, prompting the company to quickly release a patch. The bug in Windows' mechanism for confirming the legitimacy of software could have let hackers take control of a device. Telling Microsoft marks a significant change for the NSA, tasked with creating tools for U.S. counterintelligence, the agency has often kept its knowledge of tech vulnerabilities to itself. It was criticized in 2017 for devising a hacking tool, Eternal Blue, to exploit a Windows bug. The NSA lost control of Eternal Blue, letting hackers around the world have a field day, while Microsoft looked for a fix. We will pick up a couple of the health and science pieces that we didn't read last week, starting with a missing meteorite crater. Some 800,000 years ago, a massive meteorite smashed into Earth, blasting a hole that was several miles in diameter and hundreds of feet deep. Scientists have found plenty of evidence of this collision. The impact threw millions of chunks of glassy, rocky debris known as tektites across 10% of the planet from Southeast Asia to Antarctica. Researchers spent a century searching for the crater made by this impact, but kept coming up empty, reports the New York Times. Now geologists think they've located the crater underneath lava beds in Laos that are up to 1,000 feet deep. The team first discovered that tektites found in Australasia contain elements characteristic of the Laotian volcanic field. They also determined that lava beds had a relatively weak gravitational pull, likely a sign of a crater filled with broken up, less densely packed matter. Finally, boulders were found nearby that appear to have been ejected at high speed from the crater, which the researchers believe is 11 miles long, 8 miles wide, and some 300 feet deep. The next stage, says study leader Kerry C., is to drill down a few hundred meters to see if the rocks below the lavas are indeed the rocks you'd expect. Liver transplant breakthrough. A team of Swiss scientists has developed a new machine that can keep donated human livers alive for a week, a breakthrough that could save thousands of lives each year. Some 13,000 people in the U.S. are currently waiting for a liver transplant, a backlog that is partly caused by the organ's short lifespan outside the body, reports NewScientist.com. Livers can generally be kept on ice for only about 12 to 18 hours before they die. The new machine expands the organ's viability by mimicking many of the body's functions. It pumps blood through the liver, introduces nutrients and hormones, and regulates oxygen levels and blood pressure. It even moves rhythmically to replicate breathing. The idea is that we trick the liver and let it believe it is still in the body, says study co-author Pierre-Alain Clavien from the University Hospital Zurich. Initially developed with pig livers, the machine has been tested on 10 human livers that were stored on ice but too damaged for transplantation. 6 recovered full function within a week and showed a decrease in injury and inflammation levels. The developers are now planning to transplant organs preserved by the machine to assess whether the process affects liver function. And from the arts page, we'll read the review of their book of the week. The title is The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory by Andrew Bacevich. The collapse of the Berlin Wall signaled a sweeping ideological win for the American way of life, said David Holohan in USA Today. But where are the fruits of that great victory? Why is America still armed to the teeth and bogged down in the Middle East? Why are its citizens so angry and divided? Such questions have been asked before, but author Andrew Bacevich brings a unique perspective. A historian and combat veteran, he has been, even before his son died fighting in Iraq, a forceful critic of America's use of its post-1989 might. In his latest work, a book packed with insights, he argues that the U.S. has wasted its chance to build a better world by instead promulgating an empty vision of freedom that champions unfettered global capitalism and mindless consumerism while insisting on American military hegemony. Bacevich's case departs from an arguably more popular narrative that political polarization has torn us apart, said Beverly Gage in the Washington Post. A former Ronald Reagan supporter who twice voted for Barack Obama, he doubts the rift between the elected elites in Washington even matters. He considers the country's class divide more salient. In his view, both Democrats and Republicans promote free trade and authorize long-running wars, while poor and working-class Americans make the sacrifices, either in lost jobs or by suffering the traumas of combat. President Trump, meanwhile, gets off relatively easy. Though Bacevich is contemptuous of the current commander-in-chief, he reserves his greatest ire for establishment types who spend their time griping about Trump while refusing to examine their own role in creating the inequalities and foreign policy disasters of recent decades. The indictment Bacevich delivers is ultimately a spiritual one of obsessive consumption and freedom defined as escape from restraint rather than self-mastery, said Noah Millman in the New York Times. But prominent social critics of the past, including Thorstein Veblen and Christopher Lash, made similar arguments about U.S. culture. So the faults he finds in the American way probably predate 1989. Beyond that, the U.S. might not be meaningfully different in the way it has stumbled from any past empire. If America neglected to look inward after the end of the Cold War, is that a reflection of its failures or of the natural temptations of our position? History records few, if any, emperors who willingly set aside power's poisoned chalice. Here's an obituary for you. Christopher Tolkien, 1924 to 2020. As a boy in England, Christopher Tolkien grew up hearing fantastical tales of hobbits and a realm called Middle-earth. Those tales would bring renown to his father, the Lord of the Rings author J.R.R. Tolkien, and for Christopher, they would become a life's work. As literary executor following his father's death in 1973, the younger Tolkien edited or steered 24 editions of his father's poems, translations, and stories of wizards, elves, and giant spiders, pulling them together from vast troves of notes and unfinished works. The resulting books included the 1977 bestseller The Silmarillion, drawn from 12 volumes of myths and legends his father had been unable to wrest into publishable form, and The History of Middle-earth, published in 12 volumes over 13 years. For me, he once said, the cities of the Silmarillion are more real than Babylon. The youngest of three brothers, Tolkien spent much of his childhood in Oxford, where his father lectured in linguistics, said the New York Times. Christopher was a sickly child for a period and often stayed at home, giving him and his father a chance to develop a close working relationship. He became his father's assistant, earning 2 pence for each mistake he found in the published text of 1937's The Hobbit, While Christopher was stationed in South Africa during World War II, his father sent him chapters of what became the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Christopher responded with detailed constructive critiques and later drew the famous maps of Middle-earth that adorned the books when they were published in the 1950s. Tolkien followed in his father's footsteps, becoming a University of Oxford linguist, specializing in Old and Middle English, said the Daily Telegraph. After his father's death, Tolkien left academia to devote himself to his literary inheritance. The job was far from straightforward. His father had left boxes and boxes of material spanning decades, with overlapping versions of stories and notes scrawled on napkins. Tolkien was fiercely protective of his father's work and despised director Peter Jackson's big screen adaptations of The Lord of the Rings. The sale of the book's film rights in 1969 left the family with no control over the movies, which Christopher considered shallow and trivializing. Tolkien has become a monster, he said in 2012, devoured by his own popularity and absorbed by the absurdity of our time. We'll read a few of the business columns, starting with Eco Davos, jetting to Switzerland to save the world. Davos is cloaked in white, but its agenda is green, said Peter Coy in Bloomberg Business Week. Don't snicker. Yes, there was the typical swarm of private jets to whisk some of the world's wealthiest and most powerful people into Switzerland, where they paid $70,000 a ticket, plus $140,000 if they wanted to rent a chalet for the week. But climate change and the environment topped the agenda at the World Economic Forum, which celebrated its 50th anniversary this year. Many sessions were devoted to climate change, with a particular emphasis placed on ending free riding, or the tendency for businesses to shirk their own climate efforts while benefiting from the efforts others make. Seeing the hypocrisy in having billionaires jet in for lectures about their carbon footprints, the conference tried to be as green as possible. Attendees got shoe grips to help them walk the snowy promenade between meetings rather than take cars, said Andrew Edgecliff Johnson in the Financial Times. The conference rooms were decorated with seaweed-based paint and carpets made from end-of-life fishing nets. Also discouraged, paper maps of the Alpine town. Along with the new eco-conscious sensibility, Davos has invited speakers to match, said Lionel Laurent in Bloomberg.com. Among the 2020 attendees were Greta Thunberg and Micah White, the co-founder of the Occupy Wall Street movement. How's that? Davos has shrewdly realized that offering a stage to an anti-Davos crowd can work in its favor. Davos was supposed to be canceled by now. Instead, it's going strong as imitators have failed. Even the do-gooders have realized that everyone who matters is here, even if they disagree. Ah, yes, 100 billionaires descending often by private jet on an exclusive Swiss ski resort to wring their hands over climate change will surely solve the world's problems, said Walter Russell Mead in the Wall Street Journal. The new era of Davos feels like Marie Antoinette and her friends dressing up as shepherdesses to celebrate the simple life. As always, the devoirs are confident that goodwill and technocratic competence will win the day. Have they failed to notice that outside this rarefied gathering, no one is listening? One person at Davos was not buying all the climate talk, said Anne Guerin and Tulsi Olorunipa in the Washington Post. President Trump. Flying in for 2 days, he mocked environmental activists as perennial prophets of doom while trumpeting America's extraordinary prosperity. Running through economic statistics with a salesman's delivery, he demanded credit for rescuing an economy in shambles before he took office. Attendees might not all like Trump, but the plutocrats have warmed to his policies, said Andrew Ross Sorkin in the New York Times. With a stock market at record highs, two trade deals announced, and the possibility that Trump may be in office for another 4 years. The skepticism that greeted him at Davos in 2018 has dissipated. Trump's economic results have yet to prove as disastrous as many expected. He may just be the new Davos man. Now China no longer needs us. China was the clear winner in the past 2 years of trade negotiations, said Zachary Karabell. At best, the Phase One agreement signed last week by President Trump modestly revises the status quo before Trump came into office. The main takeaway, China's pledge to increase its imports of American goods by as much as $200 million over the next 2 years, barely restores China's agricultural purchases to where they were before 2017. If one of your main customers boycotts you and then agrees to start buying again but buying less, it would be disingenuous to announce that they had promised to buy more. Meanwhile, our small gains on intellectual property protections are now barely relevant. China conceded on intellectual property because it now cares far more about developing its own than stealing from the United States. The main effect of the trade war was to reinforce China's sense that U.S. was no longer a reliable economic partner. With China shifting to a consumer economy, the U.S. could have continued to benefit from China's economic rise. Instead, the U.S. has ceded whatever leverage we might have had and speeded China's push to build a domestic economy and military that are immune from the coercive whims of the United States. Amazon readies the mortal blow. Amazon's deal to sign two of America's best-selling authors should terrify publishers, said Alex Shepard. The industry has come to believe that Amazon is a monster it has learned to live with. Wrong. Novelist Dean Koontz and Patricia Cromwell each recently signed with Amazon to publish, market, and sell their thrillers, cutting out publishers altogether. Like other Amazon-published authors, they are being blacklisted by many booksellers. But this time it doesn't matter. Amazon's digital muscle makes print sales irrelevant. With Audible and Kindle, Amazon controls both the audio and digital book markets and can offer lucrative tie-ins to its ever-growing video offerings. Cornwell's new book, Quantum, has reached 600,000 readers across print, audio, and digital sales since October. Amazon's first blockbuster publishing effort came in 2011 when it inked expensive deals with actress Penny Marshall and wellness guru Tim Ferriss. Those books flopped because the e-commerce giant sold books the way it sold washing machines, believing no editors were needed. Amazon's failures lulled publishers into a false sense of security. They forgot the existential threat that Amazon poses. Now Amazon has learned from those mistakes, and it's back in full force with yet more power and leverage. On the Making Money page, we've got an article titled, Doing Good, A Boom in Socially Responsible Investing. Money surged into sustainable funds last year at a record pace, said Greg Iacuri in CNBC.com. Mutual funds and exchange-traded funds with a focus on sustainability raked in $20.6 billion in new assets in 2019, quadrupling their inflow from a year before. The funds typically invest in companies based on certain environmental, social, or governance factors, hence the often used label ESG. That might include avoiding energy companies focused on fossil fuels, investing in firms with diverse workforces, and selecting ones whose boards have the expertise to help navigate climate risk. BlackRock, the world's largest asset manager, said last week it would double its number of ESG funds to 150 as part of a pledge to address climate change. As their number grows, these funds are also getting cheaper. The inexpensive ones now charge roughly 0.1% on their assets annually, 80% less than they did in 2013. Despite those falling fees, the Securities and Exchange Commission has questioned, said Juliet Chung and David Michaels in the Wall Street Journal. As more funds broadly market themselves as strictly adhering to ESG principles, the agency is sending letters to investment managers to better understand just what that means. SEC officials are especially concerned that promises to vote based on corporate morality could undermine a money manager's duty. Another worry, said Lizzie Gurdus in CNBC.com, is how the funds are choosing their investments. Look closely and you'll see surprises. You might not expect to own a stock such as Procter & Gamble in an environmentally focused fund, but it's a staple of ESG investments. That might be because socially good stocks have struggled to outperform the bad, said John Authors in Bloomberg.com. Famed investment advisor Dan Aaron's gloriously named Vice Fund, which holds only alcohol, tobacco, gambling, and defense stocks, outperformed the market every year from 2002 until 2019. Famed investor Warren Buffett is also skeptical of the moralistic approach to investing, said Robert Armstrong in the Financial Times. Buffett recently said it was wrong for companies to impose their views of doing good, and thinks public firms should stick to maximizing shareholder value. That doesn't mean you can't make great investment returns while also helping the world, said Ben Wink in BusinessInsider.com. At least 20 ESG vehicles managed to beat the market last year. Many of the top-performing funds focused on clean energy, like BlackRock's iShares Global Clean Energy ETF, which surged 41.3% in 2019. But some broader funds have also done very well. A Vanguard ESG fund started in 2018 and based on an index of U.S. companies screened for ESG qualities, gained an impressive 32.6% last year. On the business page, we have the news at a glance. Digital tax. Trump threatens a new trade war. President Trump ratcheted up the pressure on Europe in a tech tax dispute, even as French President Emmanuel Macron agreed to a temporary truce, said Andrew Restuccia and Greg Ipp in the Wall Street Journal. American consumers face the possibility of 100% tariffs on wine, cheese, and handbags if France didn't back off a plan to tax U.S.-based tech companies. But other European countries aren't backing down. Though Trump threatened tariffs on some $60 billion worth of European automobiles and car parts if he couldn't strike a trade pact with the European Union. The UK still plans to introduce the digital tax in April if there is no comprehensive multilateral deal. The de-escalation with France is not a solution to the tax question, said Lionel Laurent in Bloomberg.com. Things would be different if Europe could set aside its differences and agree on a single digital tax, but that hasn't happened. France's decision to go ahead with such a tax on its own was politically popular, but allowed Trump to poke the soft underbelly of European unity by training his tariff weapon on Paris. Even tech leader like Apple's Tim Cook acknowledged the need for an international consensus on how to tax digital profits. Unless European countries can come together on one, they're just inviting more trade wars. And we'll read some of the business shorts, starting with more than 1.6 million secretarial and administrative assistant jobs have vanished since 2000, an almost 40% decline, comparable to that in manufacturing. Some 30% of admins now have a college degree, compared with 10% 2 decades ago. Warren Buffett was America's biggest philanthropist in the 5 years between 2014 and 2018, giving away $14.7 billion or 16.3% of his net worth, mostly to causes selected by his friends Bill and Melinda Gates, who gave $9.9 billion of their own. WeWork signed only four new leases covering 184,022 square feet of space in the last 3 months of 2019, down 93% from an average of 2.54 million square feet in recent quarters. The six biggest banks in the U.S. saved $18 billion from their tax bill in 2019, thanks to the 2017 tax cuts, helping them post a record $120 billion in combined net profits. BlackBerry no longer makes phones, but it still earns more than $1 billion a year in revenue, including $600 million for selling security software and another $200 million to $250 million for licensing its more than 38,000 patents. In 2018, the average global financial company stored about 16.2 petabytes. That's 16.2 million gigabytes of consumer data. That's up more than tenfold in just 2 years. And we'll finish, as we often do, with a quote. This comes from Jenny Offal, a novelist, who says, "Young person worry. What if nothing I do matters? Old person worry. What if everything I do does?" And with that, we're out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander at W.G. Alexander & Associates. They take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138.